Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. Last year, researchers at Human Rights Watch wrote about the global backlash against women's rights. In multiple countries, they say, hard-won progress has been reversed amidst a wave of anti-feminist rhetoric and policies, and it may take decades to reverse the trajectory. It's against this backdrop that today's guest pursues concerns at the intersection of tech and digital rights with women's human rights.
My name is Lucy Purden. I'm in the UK, and I am the founder of Courage Everywhere.
Lucy, what does Courage Everywhere do?
So Courage Everywhere is a space focused on gender justice, policy, and innovation to advance technology for the benefit of all women. And I say a space because I have just established this and I'm still figuring out what it's going to be. At the moment, it's me doing consultancy work on some fabulous projects, but I am hoping to grow it into an organization that's a great employer, for one, and can also support and fund other women's groups around the world.
Give me a sense of your trajectory. How'd you get into this work?
So I have worked in the field of human rights and tech at civil society organizations for over 10 years. So most recently, I was a senior tech policy fellow at Mozilla. And before that, I was policy director at Privacy International. And prior to that, I ran the ICT program at a think tank called the Institute for Human Rights and Business. And funny enough, the other day, I was just looking at the first project that I ever worked on, which was in 2012. And it was when the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights had just been endorsed by the Human Rights Council, and everyone was working out what it meant. And the European Commission tendered sector-specific guidance on implementing the UNGPs, and I was part of the team that worked on the ICT sector guide. And when I first started in the field of tech and human rights, working on gender and the tech sector largely meant increasing efforts to get women online in global majority countries and protecting women working in factories producing electronic goods. And as technology developed at speed, so did the harms. But back in 2011, 2012, this was the harms that we were looking at, or the impacts we were looking at. And it's kind of easy to forget that back in those days, civil society and tech companies kind of allies. You know, it was about bad governments making tech companies do bad things, taking down content or handing over details of activists. But as the years kind of went on and we learned more about the business model of tech companies, the monetizing of data, and there's no transparency about the algorithms used or recommender systems, everyone was like, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah, this is when I went to work for Privacy International and worked a bit more on business models of tech.
Could you point to a specific kind of moment in time or sort of period in time where it seems like things switched for you, where you went from that sort of sense that tech firms were more harm than help?
For me, it was definitely around 2013 with the Snowden revelations. That was one of the first things that really changed the game and kind of shone a bit more of a light of what was actually happening and the cooperation of tech companies with security agencies. But also beyond that, there was the women activists, especially from India and Pakistan, who started raising the alarm about being online, the opportunities of being online, but also this being another opportunity to be surveilled in the home and outside, and the rise of online harassment. And we've already got those women activists to thank for bringing a lot of this to our attention. And then one of the real warning signs for me about how far surveillance was being baked into our everyday was when Facebook began to use facial recognition on the platform to tag photos. And that was around 2016, 2017. And I thought, this is military grade software. And this was a real indication that we were normalizing surveillance by putting it into our everyday products. And now we're in a huge debate about the place of facial recognition in our society. And I think Facebook only removed that feature in 2021. With this lens, I've been for many years looking at tech business models for internet users. The reality is that going online means being tracked for advertising by a lot of different companies. And bringing that all back to what I'm doing now with Courage Everywhere, this business model really allows women's data to be freely available. And this has turned the products and services we use every day into tools of surveillance. And that has a particular impact on women.
So let's talk a little bit about the work that you did for Mozilla most recently. You write that the online advertising ecosystem denies women full sovereignty over their health data and by design puts women in a perpetual state of vulnerability over their safety. What was the scope of this project?
Yeah, so my Mozilla Fellowship project was called Unfinished Business. And this was looking at incorporating a gender perspective into digital advertising reform in the EU and the UK with the goal of achieving better protections for women's health data. So for this, I engaged with the femtech industry. This was a growing area of digital health that specifically focused on women's health related topics, such as period and fertility trackers, probably the best known ones. And they deal with a lot of sensitive data. So this project was really inspired by feminist research methodology, data feminism, and broadly about the impact of the misuse of women's personal data enabled by the business model of ad tech. Now, in this particular context, women's data is very valuable. So from an advertising perspective, women have more life milestones, more kind of brand capture moments, such as menstruating and having a baby. And I felt like 2023 was a good year to connect the need to protect women's health data with the exploitation in the ad tech and the data broker industry. So I think for many, the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the States in 2022 was this light bulb moment of the real life implications of data collection on a woman's safety and the surveillance that was possible through technology. And I really felt also in 2023 that there was more awareness from stakeholders that maintaining control over information is crucial for women's safety. So it was really kind of connecting the availability of women's data with safety. And one example that kind of really brought that home while I was doing the project was in the UK, a group of women's groups published this joint letter urging anyone in an abusive or coercive relationship to delete the NHS app, so the National Health Service app, which had recently granted remote access to medical records. So these women's groups were really concerned that an abusive spouse might use sensitive clinical information to undermine legal cases of custody in the family court, or that people were using contraception that was maybe forbidden in the home or the relationship. So this kind of really brought home from another angle that we really need to make sure that these sources of information are not readily available.
I want to dig in a little bit more to what are the sort of specific harms for women you see in the data broker industry and generally in the kind of surveillance ecosystem that's evolved online. How does it differ from the general set of concerns that we might have about those things?
So the harms of this kind of data being weaponized against a woman, there's a kind of a spectrum of harms here. First of all, what the ecosystem does is track behavior, combine sources of data, and make assumptions about a woman's life, and therefore in the context of advertising, what she might buy. So at one type, this really gives rise to all kinds of stereotypes about women. And for example, it's a common assumption that if a woman is of a certain age, she might want a baby. Many don't. But if a woman is pregnant, she will have a healthy baby 9 months later. And many can sadly say this is not the case. Based on these assumptions, women can be targeted with unwanted baby products if they just had a miscarriage. Now, on an individual level, targeting in this way can cause, you know, feelings of shame and grief. And on a societal level, it's perpetuating these gender norms and reinforcing stigma and taboos around the discussions of women's bodies. That's at one end. And then on the other end, women are also targeted with harmful beauty products. We have seen around the world women targeted with kind of adverts like skin bleaching or harmful surgeries as well. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we've seen what happened when Roe v. Wade was overturned and the real fear that data was going to be weaponized against you. And this might not be necessarily health data under the definitions we have, but this is location data. These are places that you visited that can say a lot about your health status or the kind of health care that you are seeking.
One of the things you point out in your report is that there are many studies on data sharing and public attitudes to data sharing, but few that sort of give you much data on women and their views. I find it interesting you point out in the studies that do provide that kind of data that women tend to show greater awareness of the uses of data. I suppose maybe that's in response to the fact that they are more surveilled. Maybe it's a reflexive relationship. What do you think that distinction means?
I mean, women have always been watched. I think you hit the nail on the head there with what you said. And yeah, I think that women do have a bit more of an awareness of of what this means, because women have always been watched for various reasons, and it's never been easier to watch women and surveil women. And I think that there is clearly a need to listen to more closely to women's concerns about data collection as it relates to their safety and well-being. And like I said in the study, women will respond when asked. I think I gave the example of the consultation in the UK for the Women's Health Data Strategy, and 100,000 women responded, which is amazing for a government consultation. And I really think what gets measured gets addressed. And this is really, really important when it comes to having disaggregated data and having a gender focus on data collection.
I want to talk about this idea of a gender perspective in policymaking and regulation. I suppose I'll start by just asking you, we've seen a bunch of different online safety bills made into law around the world, including the UK, where you are. We've got the Digital Services Act in Europe. We've done little here in the US, but there are at least some stirrings, particularly around women's health and reproductive data. What do you make of the kind of current patchwork of regulatory apparatus around the world, the extent to which it takes into consideration concerns about women in generally?
One of the reasons of doing this fellowship project at Mozilla was really wanting to plug in to some of those regulatory reforms that were happening. So you've mentioned the Digital Services Act in the EU and the Online Safety Act in the UK, which both touch on, you know, elements of advertising. But I do feel like the DSA and the Online Safety Act is trying to unpick damage that has already been done by allowing this ecosystem to flourish in the way it has. So part of the project was really trying to impress on policymakers the importance of the gender perspective in tech policymaking. Gender mainstreaming in policies is not new, but I do feel like it's been lacking in the tech policy area, and not just in kind of really looking at the tech industry, but also especially in government projects that are very data-driven, like ID, welfare, SIM card registration, which is something that's very big around the world. Like the impact of those, that data collection on women has not been analyzed. So there's some crazy examples around the world of how available women's data are from the databases of national ID, and they're being harassed and blackmailed by officials. And what that means is that they just disconnect their phones because they don't want the harassment. I think there's amazing examples from Bangladesh about this. And what you've done there, what's happening there, is that women are being removed from public life. And we often think of harassment and online harassment targeting high profile women, politicians, human rights defenders, and journalists, which is a huge problem. But we also need to look at how everyday initiatives and everyday tools that we have are being used as tools of harassment for normal women. And these are the next generation of people, of women that we want in public life. And if they're being harassed through data that's available through a welfare system or an ID system, and they're being removed from public spaces now, what chance do the next generation of women have to enter public spaces?
A lot of folks are very aware right now of the problem of non-consensual intimate imagery, deepfake pornography. It almost seems to me like a version of some of the things that you're talking about on speed. Personal data, literally someone's likeness, their identity, can be taken from them and used in this way. Taking someone's information, literally their likeness, and then using it certainly to sexualize them. But often we're seeing that used in a political context as well as a form of harassment, pushing people out of the political process.
Deepfakes are certainly a sort of paper version of non-consensual image sharing. And I remember when the phenomenon first happened, and it was blamed on the woman. It was like, why have you let photographs be taken of yourself? Why have you shared them with this? So it was all put back on it was the woman's fault for doing this in the first place. But then very quickly, it was like, actually, these aren't real photos. And it was women who had an awful lot to lose in very conservative countries. Women were going to be killed over these, and they weren't even real. They were doctored photos. So this doctoring of photos started to happen. And now we're in a situation of deepfakes where this can be, this, like you say, it's on steroids, this kind of online harassment. But the purpose is the same. The purpose is to humiliate, to embarrass, to remove women, to silence women. And silencing women can mean many different things. It can mean women don't speak out, women remove themselves from public life, women are murdered. So it is a tool of the same sort of harassment, I think, that I see online. And it's part of the toolkit. I'm seeing lots of different methods to silence women online. I've seen recent activists in Kenya where the parentage of their children is being questioned. And it's and then you've got deep fakes of women. And it only takes one photo now. The software has come on so much that it only takes one photo to make a deep fake. Whereas I think last year or the year before, it took 96. The technology has moved on at speed as well. But it's all part of the same toolkit to take women out of public life and spaces.
You point to the work of Catherine D'Ignazio and Lauren Klein, their book, Data Feminism. You say it provides us a roadmap to thinking differently about data and design. What would a sort of perspective on data feminism mean for tech companies and for governments that are developing policy?
What I really loved about the data feminism framework is that it really made me rethink how to look at the tech industry. And I think one of the main things that really stood out was about making labor visible. We talk a lot about generally about women's worth and unpaid labor that women do in the home. But I really felt like the research methodologies that the data feminism framework looks at is how to do research well, paying participants for their time. You are taking up people's time when you do these projects and you're doing research and surveys, so pay people. And that to me was just wonderful. Like, I'm really on board with that. So that was like the first thing. But then also these principles of examining power and challenging power and really rethinking all the binaries was incredibly helpful. They come in with some incredible examples of rethinking binaries, which made me, it really expanded my knowledge on both how I think about tech companies and the data industry, but also about feminism as well. Just even things about, there's a great example about how Facebook used to have like a lot of different categories for gender. And this was really forward thinking. And it was like, great, you didn't have to just tick the box of male or female when you signed up for an account. But actually at the back end, it was still identifying people as male or female because that's how advertisers want people to be classified. So it's just things like that they really brought to the fore that was so thought-provoking and really made you think that actually these are all real design choices. If we look at it from a design perspective, then a lot of the problems that we're talking about can be solved, or not solved, but can definitely be on the way to addressing. So if we reframe some of the problems that we are discussing as a design perspective, these products and these services are designed in a particular way. Let's think how we can design them differently so that they aren't excluding people, so that people can feel safe. What does this look like in the future? And that's a very feminist perspective as well, the kind of what ifs. What do we want to see? What kind of spaces do we want online? What would make us feel safe? But tech companies do have to listen to those voices and to that thinking and be willing to make changes. And we'll see how that transpires in the next few years if they're maybe forced to make those changes under the new regulation that we've highlighted.
You spend a bit of time speaking of regulation focused on GDPR and the extent to which it's been helpful or not to this particular framework or way of thinking. What do you make of GDPR? I understand we're, I think, up for another round of review on GDPR very shortly. Has it made any dent in any of the problems that you're concerned with here in this report?
So when I was about halfway through the Mozilla Fellowship project, the ICO, which is the Information Commissioner's Office, the data protection regulator in the UK, they announced they'd be conducting a review of period and fertility apps. And this came off the back of concerns from users about what data was being collected and the security of that data. And it mirrored the results of my own survey that I did for the fellowship project, where I surveyed 1,000 femtech users about their attitudes towards privacy. And that was an interesting survey because 44% said that they deleted an app due to privacy concerns, and 20% of those people specified it as a period tracker. So when interested parties say that privacy is dead, it's not true, and especially when you ask women. But the results of this ICO investigation, that they found there was no serious breaches and there was no enforcement notices issued under the data protection law, but they issued a reminder to app developers to ensure that they respect user privacy. They put some guidance for app developers: be transparent, obtain valid consent, establish correct lawful basis, and be accountable. But something I'd been thinking about in this project was the very different approach to this in the US. So I'm really interested in kind of this data protection in Europe versus consumer rights in the US, and how enforcement really differs almost on the same issue. And my interest in this really came from the Cambridge Analytica scandal in 2018, when the FTC imposed a fine of $5 billion on Facebook. And in the UK, Facebook was fined £500,000, which was the same problem, but very different enforcement. And £500,000 was the maximum that could be imposed on, maximum fine that could be imposed on under data protection laws at the time. We see more now. We don't see anything like $5 billion. So from my perspective, working on privacy and tech, the regulation that we lean very heavily on in Europe is data protection, but it can be a barrier because it can be complex for an individual to navigate. The bar for enforcement is very high, and it relies on individuals knowing what has happened to their data in order to exercise their rights, which is impossible when it comes to engaging with this very opaque digital advertising ecosystem. Now, on the other side, data brokers are much more high profile in the US, thanks to investigations about data on military personnel being sold to data brokers, sensitive data to law enforcement being sold without to bypass getting a warrant. And I feel like it's really driving the case for federal data protection in the US. And in absence of data protection in the US, it leans very heavily on consumer protections to rein in the same abuses, I think. It boils down to unfair practice. You said you wouldn't share your data with third parties, but you did. And that seems like a much more accessible and lower bar. And the FTC is really advocating around hidden impact of pixel tracing. It's coming down very heavily on companies dealing with health data.
It's rare on this podcast for someone sitting on the other side of the ocean to actually suggest that the grass is greener in the US when it comes to anything related to tech policy.
I'm not necessarily saying the grass is greener, but I'm really interested in the different approaches. And it makes me wonder where is consumer rights in this issue in Europe? I think data protection is obviously a good thing. I'm just wondering where consumer rights are in this argument. So I'm seeing good things happening with Consumers International. I think people are starting to connect the dots, but it really did make me think about this difference of data protection versus consumer rights, Europe versus the US. And the FTC has come down quite heavily on companies dealing with health data in particular. Flow, one of the period trackers, they settled in 2019 because they shared sensitive health data with marketing and analytics firms. Again, this is, you said in your privacy policy, you wouldn't share data, but you did. BetterHelp, an online counseling app whose users are reportedly mostly young and female, interestingly, they continually broke its privacy promises by sharing data extensively with Facebook, monetizing consumer sensitive health information to target them and others with advertisements. That's from the FTC complaint. And then part of the FTC complaint against Premom, an ovulation tracker, that detailed how the company requested access to a customer's location to pair a Bluetooth thermometer and then share that location data with two analytics firms in China who could then sell that information on to others. So really, I'm just not seeing this depth of regulatory action when it comes to this issue in Europe under data protection. And maybe that is because data protection really does rely on the individual making the complaints themselves. And that's really difficult to do when you don't know who has your data. So I wonder how in Europe we can make this more accessible by maybe using consumer law. It's something I'd really like to explore. I think there's something there.
Well, perhaps that fits in then to your look at fintech and the kind of growth of this space more generally. You've just mentioned several apps that are discussed in the report. I found it really interesting that you went and talked to a bunch of the leaders of these types of companies and got their views on some of these issues. What's your sense of the folks that are building tools for women? How are they thinking about privacy concerns and thinking about the fact that they're likely contributing to this ocean of information that's sloshing around everywhere?
I think on the whole, from the companies I spoke to, there was a really high level of awareness and responsibility. And some of the leaders of the femtech companies I spoke to knew what they were talking about in terms of the problems with SDKs, software development kits, trackers and pixels. But the problem is when you're growing a business, you need to advertise on social media. For all the companies were trying to ring fence a lot of the data and protect it. If you want to advertise on social media, then you hand the data over to social media. And that's not something that they wanted to do. There is also another barrier there that it's very difficult for femtech companies to advertise on social media because of the censorship of women's bodies and terms describing women's bodies, which means that they can't advertise. If they do get over that hurdle, then they're handing over a lot of data and they don't really want to do it. One of the answers I didn't quite get was whether there is pressure from investors to monetize data as the business model. And I did speak to a lot of companies that really wanted subscription to be the dominant business model, but there was a lot of pressure around that. And I think there's still like this tension between investors thinking that if you have a tech company, you monetize data as the business model. Female founders don't get a lot of investment. And it's just, yeah, it was quite a weird space. And I didn't quite get the answers that I was looking for in that respect. On the whole, I did think there was a high level of awareness, but it was a bit of a spectrum. I think some companies didn't quite understand the ecosystem itself, and some really did.
You conclude with a way forward, kind of a summary of your various arguments, an outline of harms that you've been able to taxonomize, barriers to change, everything from typical taboos in society on through to the lack of special protections for women as a protected category, and generally the problem of the surveillance advertising ecosystem that we've built over the years. But for policymakers, as far as priorities, you've got a bunch of different suggestions. If we were, I don't know, speaking to a group of policymakers, as we likely are listening to this podcast at the moment, what would you tell some of them?
It's really hard to move the dial on this issue policy-wise, even though it is an open secret how bad the industry is. But I really sympathize with policymakers on this issue because it is technically complex and it can be hard to produce the evidence of harm connected with advertising that policymakers find satisfying enough to make changes. For example, in the UK, there is advertising reform underway, but it's targeting illegal and scam adverts. So it's quite visible. Whereas the adverts that are based on behavioral targeting, or they're maybe discriminatory or targeting vulnerable people, it's much more difficult to investigate, but they're the categories that really impact women. So I just really stress the importance of looking into this. There is a demand for people wanting change. And it's really difficult to come up against because reform in this area is against the interests of most tech companies because it threatens their business model. And this is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it has a very strong industry lobby that can come out with great evidence of how much it contributes, digital advertising contributes to the economy, or how many jobs it creates. In our civil society, that is incredibly difficult to combat with the resources that we have. However, more and more investigations are coming out, more and more harms. It is an open secret how bad this is and how things need to change. I would really say to policymakers that it is now time to really encourage and test alternative advertising models. Like, we're not saying that advertising is ever going to go away, and it really does underpin the running of the internet. But we need an alternative model that relies less on personal data. We need to stem the flow of personal data, reduce the value of it. Now, this is the direction of travel. Like, you can see what is happening piecemeal, lots of different things. The death of third-party cookies, that's not going to stop things. But you can see that things are moving in this direction, but it's taking time because it's really complex. Pets, privacy-enhancing technologies, then they're not going to be integrated into everyone's browser anytime soon. But we do need investment in this area and recognition that there are harms, and just to really start moving the dial on this. And because it is the way it's going to go, we just need to speed it up a bit.
I do want to give you the chance just to nerd out, though, on some of these very specific technical suggestions that you make. You talk about wanting to investigate pixels and SDKs. You talk about deletion orders. You talk about invisible processing. What are some of the things that you think need to happen on the back end in the data broker industry?
Data brokers need to be more visible for a start. They're not household names. And like I was saying about the protections that we have in Europe, this kind of, it relies on us knowing who has our data. And I was really interested in the fact that California has this register of data brokers and that data brokers will be fined if they're not on the register, which I think is a really interesting thing to propose. I think what's really tricky about data brokers in the EU is because we have GDPR, it's unlikely that you'll see spreadsheets stuffed with personal data just flying around between companies. it gets a lot more technical and a lot more difficult to uncover because data is extracted at a technical level, like software development kits. Data brokers will buy SDK companies, and so that they have a source of data. Tracking tools such as pixels or analytics tools, there are lots of different ways that data can be extracted. I also think that location data needs to be looked at again as sensitive data, because data brokers rely so much on data being inferred, and so much can be inferred from location data. So I think we really need to look again at that. You mentioned like a review of GDPR, which is going to be happening in the middle of the year. I think at the moment it's looking on enforcement rather than just completely reviewing the whole text. But I think reviewing enforcement is really important in this field, especially when you look at the differences in enforcement across the world on this particular issue. One of the most interesting examples that has happened really recently is the company Avast, which is a antivirus software company that has been fined by the FTC in the US for selling location data and browsing behavior. This is an antivirus company selling data about their customers, which is really crazy. But what's really interesting about this company Avast is that they're based in the UK and they sold this product to a Czech subsidiary. This should fall squarely underneath GDPR as far as I can tell. So it'll be really interesting to see off the back of this action by the FTC whether the sale of browsing data belonging to EU citizens would be a violation of the GDPR. That would be an interesting case to follow this year.
Everyone's talking about artificial intelligence. That's the direction we're all headed in. Lots of concern about training data and lots of concern about biases and different models and lots of concern about how AI will draw together many of the worst elements of the tech ecosystem we have today into hyper-targeted information and more synthetic media and all the rest of that. I don't know. How are you thinking about that? How does your framework and some of the thinking you've done here, I don't know, set you up for thinking about artificial intelligence?
Yeah, this was quite a difficult project to work on in 2023, because if you weren't talking about generative AI, it was difficult to talk about anything else. But what I found really interesting about the AI debate, especially last year, was that AI was going to solve all of these problems. It was going to revolutionize healthcare. It was going to make society better. It was this utopian thing. And what's the first thing that happens? AI gets integrated into advertising. It's like, oh, okay. It's no surprise that the companies that are the leaders in advertising are also the leaders in AI, because they have amassed all of this data, which of course they can, which leapfrogs them way ahead of any other company. I think that, especially when we're talking about deepfakes and things like that, these are tools that are building on existing problems. I do quite a lot of work on elections as well. And the way I see AI inserting itself into the electoral process is that it's building on existing problems of misinformation, of political advertising, of targeting, and so on. And so we need to tackle these systemic issues as well. What's wrong with our society gets reflected in our AI, of course. I'm not the only person to say that. What I will say on a more optimistic front, though, is that when I first started in a space and tech regulation wasn't really anywhere at all, we didn't talk about regulating any kind of tech until it was like, oh God, this is awful. This spyware is terrible, or real harms were happening. But from the very beginning on regulating AI, we've been talking about liability, been talking about harms. And I think that's a good starting point when we're looking at regulating AI. Of course, there are different approaches to doing this across the world, but I have been encouraged to see that language of risk and liability and harms be in the conversations. I'm hopeful that we're going in the right way, in the right direction.
On a note of hope, perhaps that's a good place to end. Lucy Purden, good luck getting this new venture off the ground, and hope that you'll come back and tell us about how it's going in a bit of time.
Thank you so much, Justin. I really enjoyed this.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guest. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. Thank you for listening.
Palsy Press.